As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Everybody to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Taylor Rockwell, and on today's episode, we're going to be answering several listener questions and taking a look at the CONCACAF Champions League. To help me do so, I've got two gentlemen. The first remains in contention, for the vacant coaching gig at Red Bull Salzburg, not RB Salzburg. Pending a background check, it's Joe Lowry. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Taylor. I'm just going to announce it now. I will not be taking that job. I'm flattered to be considered, but it's not quite the right step in my career right now.
You're ruling yourself out of contention. Is it because of the background check? Were you nervous about that?
Oh, I'm terrified. Yeah. Don't let them do that on me. They can't find it.
I think of the three of us, you two might be the ones who maybe would come away from a background check more clean than myself. Just guessing. And that third person who I've referenced twice now, also joining us, is a man who watched every minute of the CONCACAF Champions League last night, and now he's committed several off-the-ball fouls already this morning. It's the Baron Lord himself, Adam Snavely. Hey, Adam, how you doing, buddy?
On the Total Soccer Show today, it's Adam Snavely. Dun, 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 dun. Hi, everybody.
Oh, Toto. God. Wow. Okay.
That is. Thank you, Joe. It took me a minute to figure it out. I wasn't sure if that was like the CONCACAF Champions League theme for a second there. And I was out of the loop.
Taylor, you clearly have not spent enough time around a cappella groups.
That is correct, and I aim to keep it that way. Have you spent a lot of time around a cappella groups?
Not at all, but I like to sing.
Okay, all right. But you were not in one in college or anything
Absolutely
like that?
Absolutely not.
I feel like you might have been wearing a Letterman jacket and snapping those fingers. I feel like it's in there.
I wore a Letterman jacket in high school, soccer and swimming. Thank you. Two sport athlete. Mm-hmm. But in college, I was mostly well known for writing poetry. So, I mean, take that however you will.
A Letterman poetry jacket. I like it. Well, you are both here to help me talk about these listener questions, to also talk about the CONCACAF Champions League. And Adam, since you watched both of the games last night in their entirety, what were your general impressions? Because I will admit that I watched them with like half an eye on them, half an eye on everything else that I was doing. So waking up to Twitter this morning, it feels like the reaction has been the officiating was terrible and all of this is unjust. But it also feels like three and maybe four of the group of the teams playing, probably just three of the four, feel aggrieved by the officiating, which means maybe it was bad on all parts.
Yeah. So the officiating was intriguing at several points in time. And it's also very funny simply because specifically, I think Columbus fans feel aggrieved at the officiating decisions made in their game, which prevented them from winning, and also Club America fans in the other game from last night felt particularly aggrieved with the last second penalty call. The officiating in general, which, in fairness to Club America fans, there were 41 fouls committed last night between the two of the Portland Timbers and the and Club America. There were, I think, 8 or 9 yellow cards. Maybe I'm checking that now. There were nine yellow cards, and somehow Claudio Bravo got like 7 of them. So there is a lot to complain about, certainly. But at the end of the day, the results to me felt more or less fair. And honestly, if I was a fan of either Mexican club, I would still be feeling pretty okay right now.
And Joe, if you're a fan of either of these MLS teams, what would you make of these results? Because it did feel like there was all this momentum. I'll speak for myself in saying that I was pretty hyped after the last round, that it seemed like we might have more than just one team make the semis / the final. Now I'm less confident. I'm wondering where you are on that one.
I think if you're Portland, you're feeling great. A 1-1 result at home, it comes in a strange way. Yeah, but if you tell Portland, okay, you're going to run out against Club America and get that draw at home, you're going to have to give up one away goal, but then you can go back to Mexico and pretty much just need to win or keep it scoreless. I mean, or win a multiple goal draw, excuse me. I think that's fine for them, and I think they take that. Columbus, with the way that game went down, giving up that late equalizer, they're kind of in the Club America shoes for their game. That's a tough one. And you come in without Lucas Elrion for the next game after he picks up a yellow card early on in that first half. You're in a tough spot, giving up 2 away goals and now having to go down to Mexico. And the other difficult thing is Monterrey didn't come in with the first choice 11. Javier Aguirre didn't bring his first choice guys or a lot of his first choice guys even to Columbus for this game. And so when you're up 2-1, you think, okay, this is the result we need against a weakened Monterrey side. And when that doesn't stick, that result doesn't hold, you're in a little bit of a tougher spot headed into that second leg.
Do you have any thoughts on what they might be able to do to get back into this, needing those away goals or at least one away goal and then keeping a clean sheet without Zelarayan? Are there things Columbus could do to limit what Monterrey will try to do in that game?
Honestly, I don't think they're going to try to change a whole lot from the style that we've seen Caleb Porter implement with this team. Zelarayan's going to be out, so we're probably going to see Pedro Santos inside as a number 10. He's fully capable of doing that job. He usually starts on the wing and the tucks inside anyway, so it's not a totally dissimilar role for Pedro Santos. I think the crew are going to go down and say, okay, we need to control the game a little bit. We need to win the ball. We need to use the ball to create goal-scoring opportunities. It kind of is, at times, similar to how Greg Berhalter played with the crew. It's a little less, it emphasizes ball movement and ball possession a little bit less. But I would expect the crew to go down to Monterrey, control possession as best they can, and try to use that possession to create chances. And if they can do that effectively, they definitely still have a chance to win this thing.
Final quick question for me for Adam in our abbreviated CONCACAF Champions League review. Is Adam watching live with the penalty call at the end of the Timbers game? Merritt Paulson can be seen very, very adamantly claiming it was a penalty. But I'm wondering, when you were watching, what your thoughts were on that decision and how confusing you found the end of that game to be.
It is one of those impossible to make handball in the box decisions for me. You are going to upset some people. You are going to be right or wrong, basically any way you slice it. Because the player for Club America, I can't remember who the foul was actually called on. But the player for Club America was already falling down. He can't control that he's falling down. It just is happening before the shot even takes place. And so his arms are naturally going down to the ground so that he doesn't slam his head into the turf, which is fair. I think that we all have the right to that. And the shot just gets hammered right at him and it hits his arms and he's, you know, like a foot away and he can't do anything, but his arms are out and they stop the ball from traveling to goal. And so I feel like we're having to go into the metaphysics of refereeing and kind of like talk about like ontological arguments about what is the spirit of the handball and what is not. I feel like I've seen them given and I feel like I've seen them not given. Ultimately, it's just one of those calls that it's like, until we have a more clearly worded kind of laws of the game on that, you're not going to please everybody with a decision ever.
Yeah, because I think it always comes down to what the official is looking for in that moment. And when you have the scrum and there's contact all over the place, I think there is a world in which you see that incident and it looks like the player throws himself in front of the shot. And then there's an argument to be made that he's out of control, but he's deliberately out of control to block that shot. So the handball is given. Then there's the counter argument of no, he's fouled. No, he's clipped. No, there's contact. And that's why he's falling. And I think it always comes down to, yeah, the gray areas, the sort of back and forth you can have about the call, but fundamentally it ends up being a penalty. So I guess that's good for Timbers fans. Joe, did you have anything to say or anything to add on that penalty, or should we get to some listener questions?
Oh, let's get to the questions. It's a wild all moment, right. And I don't want to talk about the metaphysics of refereeing or the spirit of the handball. So we can carry on.
I will say really quick that one of the funny, like seeing all of a sudden Felipe Mora jump into the arms of Merritt Paulson was one of the funniest images I think I've seen in quite some time. That was a personal favorite for myself.
I did enjoy that it resembled that like ending sequence did resemble like the end of a war movie when you're not really celebrating that the battle is over. It's just like, okay, all right, nobody celebrated the penalty aside from the fans and Merritt Paulson. All the players were just exhausted by the end, I think.
Oh, so. Felipe Mora was celebrating. Let me tell you what. There were definitely a couple players that were celebrating.
All right, that's probably fair. All right, well, let's talk about Bayern Munich. Let's talk about RB Leipzig because we have 7 listener questions to get to. As always with TSS listener questions, they are all over the place, but they're starting in an obvious one from Tyler Kinsella or Kinsella. We have 3 different questions. We'll get to them individually. In a surprise to absolutely no one, Bayern Munich appointed Julian Nagelsmann as their manager. What can we expect from Bayern in a bit of a transition next year under him? Same question, but for Jesse Marsch at Leipzig. And finally, will a top 4 Bundesliga side be too much of a jump for Marsch? So let's start with the first one, Joe. What should we expect from Bayern Munich under Julian Nagelsmann?
I think we should expect Bayern Munich to look a lot like what RB Leipzig have looked like under the last couple of years under Julian Nagelsmann. So Hansi Flick was using this 4-2-3-1 shape with Bayern Munich. It was something that we'd almost grown comfortable with watching Bayern Munich. Occasionally he tweaked things, but that was his go-to approach. Nagelsmann is not bound to a singular approach. At Leipzig, he used a 4-2-3-1, but he also used a 3-4-3, a 3-5-2, a 4-3-3. You get the idea. Taylor, you and I have talked about a lot of the different tactical wrinkles that Nagelsmann's used at Leipzig, kind of looking through the lens of Tyler Adams a little bit. Nagelsmann is much more of a principle-based manager and much less of a formation-based manager. And so I think for all of us getting ready to watch Bayern Munich next year, don't expect to see one singular lineup, one singular set of positioning. Instead, I think we're going to see a whole bunch of different looks that are designed to get a lot of numbers in central midfield, that are designed to get fluidity on the wings. We've seen Adams rotate in and out from wide to central a whole bunch over the last couple of seasons. Aggressive center back play, that'll be similar from Flick over now to Nagelsmann. And then a high line, also similar. So there are some things that are going to be the same, but I expect to see more fluidity, more emphasis on rotation and checking your teammates to see how you're supposed to move on the field. And overall, that could make Bayern Munich look even more like a modern soccer team in 2021-2022.
And are there players, Joe, for Bayern Munich that you think will be like even stronger or in better positions under the system that Nagelsmann will utilize or the style of play he wants to utilize? And conversely, are there players that you think maybe might be on the outside or might take some time getting used to it? Because for me, like honestly, like Robert Lewandowski is an example of a player who could fit the system. But I think of Nagelsmann's Leipzig teams, even his Hoffenheim teams, and they seem to be predicated on pacey counterattacks if that situation is on. Not to say Lewandowski is slow, but I don't think of him being as this like line-breaking striker. So I think there will have to be some tweaking and some tinkering to make sure that it kind of complements one of the best strikers in the world as opposed to ostracizes.
No, I totally agree. And that's an interesting point to think about some of the old guard, right? Because some of the old guard is leaving. Jerome Boateng and David Alaba are going to be gone. Dayot Upamecano is going to be in. And so now you still have Thomas Müller. You still have Robert Lewandowski. How are those guys going to adjust? I can see it taking a little bit longer. I totally expect both of them to be key parts of Nagelsmann's Bayern Munich team. but it could take them a little longer to figure out how to actually play within a different set of tactics and a different system. A couple players that I think could really benefit, Serge Gnabry is one of them. He played under Julian Nagelsmann before at Hoffenheim, and he's been used as a wingback under Nagelsmann before at Hoffenheim. And so we could see Gnabry inside, we could see him higher up the field as a winger, or we could see him a little bit deeper playing as maybe a right-sided wingback rotating inside. Lucas Hernandez is another guy. I think he'd be a great fit for that Mukele role that we saw at Leipzig, that center-back, full-back hybrid. He's already done that a little bit under Hansi Flick, but it's been more deliberate. You're playing full-back in this moment. Okay, now we're making a sub. Now you're playing center-back. Under Nagelsmann, I expect those players to move fluidly during the run of play. So Lucas Hernandez could be a guy. Alphonso Davies, another one. Joshua Kimmich. Bayern Munich has a ton of flexible guys already. And a lot of those players, I think, are really set up to thrive under Nagelsmann.
And Adam, the other thing Bayern Munich has is the reputation of being Bayern Munich. They're always going to be a frightening team or intimidating team to play. I know you as a Dortmund fan probably enjoy those games, but are also slightly nervous when Bayern Munich come to town. And I think like where I'm coming from with this question is that there are managers that intensify that reputation, and then there are managers that do the opposite of that. So I would argue like Niko Kovac is one who... he has some experience. He's this exciting appointment theoretically, but I don't know if he made Bayern a more intimidating team, or like they didn't seem more intimidating under him. And obviously their performances were not. For you as a fan of Dortmund or at least a nominal fan of Dortmund, like what does Nagelsmann moving to Munich do for you? Are you more scared of them, or do you think there's like, I'm not sure how this is going to go. I think Dortmund could maybe find a way through.
A nominal fan of Dortmund.
Well, I just don't want you to be speaking from a, like, I'm an expert, I know all the things standpoint. That's all.
Sure. That's fair.
The biggest Dortmund fan of the world. How about that?
Maybe not, but I am a Dortmund fan and I wear that proudly.
There we go.
No, I think that it's kind of impossible to make Bayern Munich more scary at this point, just because they have been so utterly dominant for the last, whatever, 7-8 years. Whatever, however long it's been since the last time that Dortmund won the league, since they were the last team to win the league that was not named Bayern Munich. So in a way, it's kind of like, all right, like you've got a new coach and it's Julian Nagelsmann. And that's, I mean, like he is a good coach. I think I respect Julian Nagelsmann a lot. I think that when I look at the appointment though, and look at what Nagelsmann is known for, and kind of specifically how he has this reputation as a tinkerer, where he is a person that he has a million tactical ideas seemingly all the time, and he's frequently changing how his team is shaped and what his team is doing in those shapes mid-match. Like that is something that I've heard a lot about and seen a lot from Julian Nagelsmann's team. And part of me wonders, and maybe it's an eternal optimist in me, part of me wonders if he doesn't end up being a phenomenal fit for Bayern simply because they are not broke and he might try to fix them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. That's a really interesting point.
I think that especially, I mean, under Hansi Flick, a lot of the time Bayern were just kind of like keeping it simple, stupid. Like it wasn't there weren't massive tactical innovations that were coming out of Bayern Munich. It was, we're putting our best players in their best positions and we're relying on our quality to beat you a lot of the time. And that has been good, and not just enough. That has been good, like very good for a long time. Good enough to win a Champions League. I don't want to take anything away from Bayern or Hansi Flick. They knew exactly what they needed to do to win, and they executed on those concepts. I wonder a little bit if Julian Nagelsmann tinkers Bayern out of dominance. And also it's kind of a meme a little bit among Dortmund fans now that for whatever reason, for a long time, Dortmund just plays for some reason out of their skull against Leipzig. That is a thing. Like for whatever reason, no matter how poorly Dortmund seems to be doing a lot of the time, Dortmund beats Leipzig a lot of the time. That is a kind of established pattern at this point. So if anything, I mean, yeah, I guess Bayern signing one of the most eligible coaching candidates in the world is a little bit scary. And I think as an objective outside soccer observer, I can say that. But also as a Dortmund fan, I'm not that concerned. And in a strange way, I might be even a little hopeful that maybe these things come to pass that knock Bayern off their perch a little bit with the coaching change.
And Joe, do you think Leipzig fans should be feeling an equal amount of trepidation with Jesse Marsch coming in? How do you think that could work out for them?
I think it could work out really well. It's hard. Adam, you and I have actually talked about this before on an episode of the Total Soccer Show. We had a question about Jesse Marsch. But Jesse Marsch is coming in and he's this really promising coaching prospect. He's had success in New York. He's had success with Salzburg in Austrian domestic competitions. But I think there's just one cloud hanging over Jesse Marsch. And I personally don't really buy into this cloud, but there is this cloud over Jesse Marsch, and it's that he's never made it out of the Champions League group stage in Europe. He's never gotten out in his two tries with Salzburg. If he had, I think this appointment would be just incredible for RB Leipzig, but he hasn't. And so Salzburg didn't make it out. It's such a tricky kind of in-between job with Salzburg. You're selling your best players on halfway through the year more often than not. You're this transition job. You're a transition team within the Red Bull system. And so I think that Marsch is going to be a success at RB Leipzig. That could be some American bias. I've watched him give some coaching presentations before. I really buy into what he's doing on a personal level. I think he's a really interesting guy with a lot of interesting ideas on how to play soccer, and they've clearly been successful ideas. I don't know how he'll do at Leipzig. I don't think the move is too much of a jump or anything like that. I think he's ready for this step, but I don't know how RB Leipzig fans will perceive him being appointed as their manager.
Is that really a criticism that's been extended, like his way, never getting out of the group stage? Because that feels a little bit to me like criticizing a minnow for not being a shark.
Yeah,
like, that
right?
Doesn't seem in two opportunities as well. It's not like he's been coaching in the Champions League for 40 years and has never found a way through.
I will say, if I can interject here, it's not just that he hasn't gotten out of the group stage of the Champions League. It's also that he hasn't had much in the way of famous Europa League victories, because Marco Rosa was the Salzburg coach before him, correct? If I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
Because under Marco Rosa, Salzburg actually did pull out some pretty impressive Europa League victories and made a couple of deep runs in that competition. And even though Marsch's teams have put in some very impressive Champions League performances, obviously the Liverpool game comes to mind, and the half English, half German, very epithet laced halftime speech was kind of seen around the world, I guess. He hasn't been able to kind of like replicate that same success in terms of actually completing something of a famous victory. So I think it's a little bit more complex than just he hasn't gotten out of the Champions League. I don't think that people are necessarily expecting Jesse Marsch to take Red Bull Salzburg to the Champions League finals.
So final question for both of you on this topic then would be, will a top four Bundesliga side be too much of a jump for Jesse Marsch? Joe, why don't you start us off with this one? I think Adam sort of alluded to this earlier, or maybe just openly said it, but I'm inclined to think that maybe Bayern could be a bigger jump for Nagelsmann than Leipzig will be for Marsch. That's kind of where I'm coming from for this one, but I look forward to hearing where you all are on this one.
Yeah, it's hard for me to compare those two jumps. But I think the fit is natural for Jesse Marsch. You know, I made that whole Champions League comment before because I think that is, and European competition in general, now that Adam's provided a bit more context there, I think that is a fair thing to think about as Marsch makes this transition. But I think he's a good coach. He's spent time with Leipzig already. He's been an assistant there under Ralf Rangnick before during the 2018-2019 season after he moved from the New York Red Bulls over in Major League Soccer. And so he's familiar with how that organization operates from inside Leipzig and from outside. He plays a style of soccer that will be very familiar to the fans of that team and to the players of RB Leipzig. It seems like a good fit. I don't think this is too big of a jump for Jesse Marsch at all.
I agree with Joe. I don't think this is a significantly like big or huge jump for Jesse Marsch. And I mean, talking about the familiarity with the style, I think just the style itself that Jesse Marsch plays is one that is always going to be at least relatively successful. If you are gathering the players and getting them bought into that pressing system, because it is a kind of a return to a little bit more. It's hard to call anything about RB Leipzig old school, just because they are such a new team in most sense of the word.
If you're like 19, they're old school.
Yeah. If you're 19, if you're a true zoomer, I suppose that is the case. But it's a return to, it's more of a return to what Leipzig looked like under Ralf Rangnick. It's a return to that kind of original, those original upstart Leipzig teams that kind of took the Bundesliga by storm. The high press style is going to yield you results a lot of the time. And I think that especially given the resources at RB Leipzig's disposal, and I think that we're not going to see something like a Bob Bradley situation where you have a team that has signed the coach and then only gives him like a couple months and then, oh, a couple results didn't go our way, so we're going to fire him immediately. I think that there is going to be a little bit more investment in Jesse Marsch succeeding. And giving him time to work things out if he needs time. I don't think that this is too much of a jump for Jesse Marsch at all. And I think that the support system around him is going to facilitate his success rather than be on the lookout for the first sign of trouble.
Well, Tyler, I hope that we have answered all three of those questions. And American soccer fans, I hope you all are feeling optimistic about Jesse Marsch at Leipzig. Bayern fans, I hope you're feeling even more optimistic, even though you don't deserve any more optimism because you win all the time anyway. It doesn't matter. You'll be fine.
I don't hope you feel optimistic.
While Adam continues to throw negativity towards Bayern Munich, and I would say it's understandable given, you know, the nominal nature of his fandom, we will be back with more listener questions in just a moment.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Welcome back to the Total Soccer Show. We've got many more listener questions to get to. The first one is going to Mr. Adam Snavely. It comes from James Chukka, who asks, I'm going to simplify this one down. If you had to select a World Cup qualifying roster tomorrow and you're the head coach of the national team, are you selecting Daryl DK and what are you going to do with him in your system? And then the second part of the question would be, what do you think Greg Berhalter would actually do given the system that he already has in place? So, Adam, would you put him in there? And if so, how would you use him? And then we'll get to the Berhalter aspect in a little bit.
Well, Taylor, recency bias be darned. I will say that I think that I would put Daryl DK in any theoretical World Cup or top 23 roster that the U.S. would be putting out right now. And that's simply because there's almost nobody that really fits his profile in the striker pool that the U.S. has. And if you look at a lot of the other options, there's a lot of different player profiles that exist, but there's nobody that really combines Daryl DK's strength, his speed, his ability to move off the ball. And I think that we've seen with Barnsley, a little bit of an increasing ability to find the open spaces and get looks, which was one of the primary concerns, I think, with Daryl DK going forward into his pro career. Is there's obviously talent. There's obviously an abundance of physical gifts. Is he getting into scoring positions enough? Is he being ruthless enough and getting into those spots where he needs to be? And I think that we have seen growth there at Barnsley. So when I'm thinking about the U.S. top 23, I'm thinking about that and how in Berhalter's system, a lot of the time we have seen, I think, Josh Sargent kind of take on the nominal number one striker role, which is fine because I like Josh Sargent and I think that he does a lot of good things. But even if you're just bringing Daryl Dike in as a person that you can bring off the bench, we saw that North Ireland game. He didn't score, but he came in and he was immediately a problem for Northern Ireland. It was immediately apparent that this is something very different than what the U.S. has shown us so far. And we can now see the U.S. going direct and being a scoring threat in any direct situation simply because this person is on the field, which makes a huge, huge difference. In terms of what I think Berhalter will do, I think the big debate...
Well, let's hold off on that one.
We'll
for
hold
a minute,
off on that.
That's,
okay.
Yeah, because that's one that I feel like is an entirely different conversation, weirdly enough. But for me, I'll just answer really quickly because James gave us the opt-out of I'm building this roster tomorrow. I would say, yeah, I would, because I think the way Barnsley play is probably the way my team is going to play if I'm building a roster tomorrow for competitions in the near future. It's going to be long ball. It's going to be him having to do a lot of running and fighting to hold the ball up so other people can get in and around him or like around him so we can get some goals. So I think, yeah, I would put him in my team. Joe, would you put him in yours? And if so, how would you utilize him?
I would. This is hard because I think for me, it boils down to how many strikers do you want to bring to whatever competition, specifically World Cup qualifying, as it's named in the question.
Let's go with your 11 that you built where we have 11 strikers on the
Perfect.
Field.
Yeah. So I'm bringing 11 number nines. No, I think Perfect. I'm team bring two strikers. And so Josh Sargent for me is going to be one of them. Then it's a question of who the second one is. Is it Jossie Zardes? Is it Daryl Dike? Is it Jesus Ferreira? And for me, it is Daryl Dike because the grass is long in World Cup qualifying sometimes. And sometimes you need to play over that grass instead of on top of that grass. And Daryl Dike, I think, is the best player, best number nine suited to playing in that kind of style.
All right. So I think we all agree we would put him on our rosters. Now, the other question, the maybe more important question, but less important at the same time. Adam, would Greg Berhalter put him on the roster?
I think at this point that... Yes, I think the answer to that question is yes, he would. And I think that we come to that simply because I feel like he is a little bit more comfortable and a little bit more settled with Josh Sargent as an option at striker that's always going to be there. He has a safety blanket option in Jossie Zardes, I think. And I think that the big positional battle for Daryl Dike and the big person that would be someone who is preventing him from getting on the roster at this point would be Jozy Altidore. And at this point, in the last year or so, when we've seen Jozy Altidore called up to the national team, he's ended up not playing. And we've seen and heard talks of little injuries, little tweaks that have occurred. And then Jozy has released cryptic tweets in response to those. And there's been a lot of speculation. And frankly, I'm kind of at the point where I have no idea where Jozy Altidore stands with Greg Berhalter. And kind of the last time we saw Jozy with the U.S. men's national team for an extended run and as kind of the undisputed number one striker was 2019 Gold Cup. And we're now already almost 2 years from that point. So I think that's the big positional battle and big person that Daryl Dike would need to be out. And at this point in time, I think he has the edge.
All right. So Adam is putting Daryl Dike on Greg Berhalter's roster. Joe, are you doing the same?
I am. Yeah, I think Greg will bring him. I think it's going to be Sargent. I think it's going to be Zardes. And I think it's going to be Dike. It makes sense to have that mix of skill sets. You're going to need to play a lot of games in a short amount of time. Having three out and out strikers probably does make a bit more sense. I just would use Tim Weah, I think, instead of Jossie Zardes as that third striker. You get a little bit more positional versatility there. But I think it makes sense for all the reasons we've said for Berhalter to bring Daryl Dike to pretty much any competition right now.
I am of the same opinion, so I won't even add anything else aside from, yeah, let's get Daryl Dike on that plane. Let's win the World Cup. I think that's fair to assume we will. While I assume away, I will also ask our next question. It comes from Jackie Choi. As a follow-up to the question about the Wando phenomenon last week, which would be players who had otherwise good careers, but like one very negative moment that stands out? Who are some players who are the opposite, who weren't actually that incredible, but who are beloved for a heroic moment during a game? The, well, we'll always have blank sort of players. I think in the past I've talked about Federico Maqueda being this type of player for Manchester United, coming in and scoring a ridiculous goal. Then I think he scores one more, and then I think it kind of goes downhill from there. But in the title winning season, he is, or in that title winning season, I should say, he was very instrumental. I've got one or two other nominees, but Adam, I'm excited to hear who you have as one of your nominees.
I think the term is the streets won't forget, right?
Yeah,
that's the type of people the streets will remember. X player. So yeah, Federico Maqueda is kind of the poster child. I'm pretty sure I have actually been on an episode where we have talked about him, and this is kind of a similar question in a way. But I did have a couple of ideas, a couple of thoughts, and I'm going to lead off with one that I think is not as obvious an answer to this question, and it might be cheating because it's happened so long ago. But I select as my first player for this question, Joe Gatens of the 1950 United States World Cup team, because he scored that goal against England, and everybody talks about how he was that person that did that. That happened, you know? And then promptly we really never hear from him again. And I think that's the type of really true, like one game wonder. My favorite fun fact about him in general is that he was never actually a United States citizen. He was a player from Haiti who lived in the United States for a while. And, it was a time when international soccer eligibility was real fast and loose. And he just randomly showed up at the World Cup to play for the United States. And we have that game, for the US, and they complete that shocking 1-0 upset of England. And then we promptly kind of like don't really hear much from him again. I think he went to France to play for a while. But yeah, that's definitely one person I had there. I also, for the sake of, my mother, I had to shout out, Josimar from Brazil and the 1986 World Cup, where that was really like a game and a half. Cause he kind of came on as an unknown kind of substitute, against, I believe it was Northern Ireland, and then played the next game also against Poland and had two unbelievable goals. And it was kind of like, nobody knows who this person is, but maybe he's the best right back in the world. And then he kind of just promptly does nothing else. I think he spent 4 years at Botafogo in Brazil, and then the rest of his career never spent more than two seasons at a club, was just constantly bouncing around and not making a ton of noise. And then the last person that I had was, a Russian forward, Oleg Salenko, because he in the 1994 World Cup against Cameroon, he scored 5 goals in a game. And he won the Golden Boot that year at the World Cup with 6 goals. He only scored one other goal, but because of that one game, essentially, he won the Golden Boot. He got himself a move to Valencia and promptly really never did much of note ever again.
Wow. All right. I think Adam has gone deep into the history bank, and I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Because I was not willing to do that level of research, but Adam did. Joe, where were you in your research?
I decided to go fully domestic and stay here in the United States for my two picks. Number one, Aurelien Collin, who helped Sporting Kansas City win the 2013 MLS Cup. Collin's now a center back, a reserve center back for the Philadelphia Union. But in that game in 2013 against RSL, he scores the game-tying header, and then he scores the game-winning penalty over Nick Raimondo with a really well-placed right-footed finish. It was Sporting Kansas City's 10th penalty in that game, so he certainly wasn't a first-choice guy to take that penalty. RSL then come up and miss their game-tying penalty. So Sporting Kansas City win that game thanks to Aurelien Collin, who's French. He played some in France, Spain, Scotland, England, Greece, I wrote down Portland, but I'm very sure I meant to write Portugal. And then here in the United States with Sporting Kansas City, Orlando, the Red Bulls, and now, as I mentioned before, Philly. He hasn't done anything so far in his career to equal that one moment in MLS Cup, and I want to give him credit for that. The other guy quickly that I had is Thomas Asal. I kind of cheated here. This is the MLS's back tournament legend from last year in goal for the Vancouver Whitecaps, who saved 87 bajillion shots against Sporting Kansas City in the round of 16 in that tournament. He's only 21, so there's time for him to continue dominating in net, but he's not a starter for the Whitecaps this year. He just got those couple games because Vancouver's first two goalkeepers were out, and he put on a heck of a show in goal. And I just, more so than anything, I just wanted to shout out Thomas Asal. So thank you for this question, because Jackie, you gave me an excuse to do that.
Saskatchewan Schmeichel.
Oh yeah, Saskatoon Schmeichel.
I love you guys. So, my other one that I had is maybe doesn't quite fit the categories the way you all have done so perfectly, but I'm going to throw Mario Götze in there as had a good career, but then also I think has, like, if you think Mario Götze, you don't think like, oh man, that guy is the best player in the world. You think like, what happened to him? Is he okay? Are there injury issues? I know there was a medical thing, but maybe there was some discipline stuff. I'm not sure. Like, he doesn't have that guy is one of the best players, or like certainly one of the most important players for both Dortmund and Bayern Munich somehow, and also Germany. But scoring a World Cup winner, I think, will forever cement you in the good books, in the hearts of the German people. That's what I'm going with. So Mario Götze, and Adam, I apologize if I've horrifically offended you.
I mean, I'm not offended. I just take issue with the assertion that Mario Götze has one game, but that's fine. You know what? You're entitled to your opinion.
All right. Well, I appreciate that you have not come through the microphone to attack me. Let's get to our next question, which comes from, I believe, Kenneth Seiden. Do you think the amount of talk about a large roster turnover from Olympic qualifying to the actual Olympics had a negative effect on the players during qualifying? Joe, what do you think? Do you think the narrative about the reduced roster size would have had an impact on the team during qualifying?
No. I don't, to put it as succinctly as I can. For me, that should motivate players, right? The Olympic qualifying tournament is an opportunity for guys, some of whom might not have been first choice. Atlanta United kept some of their guys out that maybe would have jumped ahead of a couple of the players on that small roster. And so this is a group of players that had a chance to prove themselves, to earn a spot in the Olympics. For me, that's huge, right? And it's always going to be that way a little bit, where there's this overarching threat of roster turnover. If some of the senior level guys want to come and play in that tournament, you might get booted. But you're probably not going to get booted if you ball out in Guadalajara. And so for me, regardless of what that narrative was, it seems like Guadalajara and that whole tournament was a chance for some of these players to actually show themselves and perform really well and earn a spot in Tokyo. And so I think the answer is no. I think this conversation about that turnover should have motivated these guys. Although I might be the only one who thinks that way. Do you guys agree, disagree? Where are you at?
Where I am is that, yeah, I think it's sort of a down the road sort of problem, where you know it's a thing that is going to have to be dealt with, that you're going to have to handle at some point, but you don't need to handle it right now. And when you're in camp for qualifying, or when you're in camp for the national team, I think it's so competitive and such a demanding environment that there isn't really a luxury of how will this tackle or this pass impact my ability to make that Olympic team down the road. I think it's all sort of blended together probably, and there's a hope or an expectation that if I perform well in training, if I perform well in friendlies and in some of the qualifying games, then maybe I will be able to make that team. But I don't think it's an ever-present thing. I will say that I am not a professional footballer, nor have I ever been. So I don't know how much there is the sort of like brooding competitiveness and the brooding negativity. I've been on teams where there was definitely competition for a certain place. And with that, sometimes you get the camaraderie of like picking each other up and helping each other along. You tend to get that with goalkeepers, I think, at the professional level. There's some competition, but there's also a lot of support. But you will have those players who are sort of like fist, like clenching a fist in celebration when a goal is missed or an extra point goes wide. That maybe there's that competition does breed some level of negativity, but I don't know how much of that can exist in a team like the US, because I think it takes a back burner to winning and remaining really competitive. So Joe, I'm with you. in that I went longer to say, no, I don't think it has that big of an impact. Adam,
yeah,
what do you think?
I agree. I don't think it really comes into play. And I don't want to belabor the point too much because I think that we're all saying the same thing more or less. But I do want to make the point that I think specifically in the little American soccer sphere, I think these players have to be aware of the conversation surrounding the U.S. failure to qualify for multiple men's Olympics in a row in soccer. I think that there's no way that they don't see that. They don't know that conversation and what has occurred the last several times. And I feel like there has to be at least some sort of motivation just to say, we are the ones who snapped that. We are the ones who went in and got and handled our business. Basically, we got the job done. We did the thing that we needed to do. We're not going to be the carriers of this legacy, more or less. I think that if I was a player, that desire to just not be the ones that continued that legacy of we're not qualifying for the Olympics would far outweigh any concern about, oh, what if I get left off the final Olympic roster? I don't think that you can even be thinking about that at all in light of the fact that the U.S. has not qualified for the Olympics in so long. The last time we had qualified for the Olympics, we were playing Sasha Kljestan as a U23 player. It was a long time ago. So I don't think it really comes into play very much at all.
So this is fascinating. I don't know where you two were on this one. I 100% was coming at this from the women's team perspective.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wait.
Yeah, that's which I think I'm wrong. I think I'm wrong to do. But I definitely read that because there's so much talk about how the women's rosters are going to be pared down to 18. I think the men's are too. I'm not sure. But I assumed it was that, like the competition for places in the team. No, you all are definitely right. But I think I like that we all still agree fundamentally.
Are we? Are we right, though? Is that,
yeah, we've got to be.
Yeah, I think so, because I think the question, seeing it from that other lens, this is fascinating. I think seeing it from the lens that you all saw it from makes a lot, as much or more sense, because it is sort of, if you are one of those players who maybe was on the bubble of making the team and then you did, but you know that if we qualify, better players could come along, are you so worried about that that you're not performing to the level of expectation and the level of your overall ability? I could see how that would have an impact, to be honest. I don't think it did. I don't think it's the primary answer. I could see how they smaller.
I don't know. Because has women's Olympic qualifying that already occurred like a long time ago. So
yeah, I think so. Like I kind of like it's such a strange thing. I think mostly I'm just focused on the 21 to 18 aspect of the roster churn. But I think that's where probably it shows that you all are approaching this from the proper perspective.
I feel bad. I hope I didn't mistake the question. I hope that we've answered the correct one.
I think you all have. I think I have not. So while we regroup from this stunning revelation, we'll take a break to hear from today's sponsors, and we'll be back with our final three questions.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Welcome back. Final segment. Three questions to go. The next one for you, Adam, from Robert Cordova. Would staggering which players jump be a better option than having players on the ground during a free kick? Oh, we're getting into the tail section of the show when the weird questions come out. With teams taking part in placing a player on the ground like a corpse next to the wall during free kicks, I offer a different option. Players would stagger the jumping. An example would be in a four-player wall from left to right, player one and player three would jump. Player two and player four do not. Did I fix the problem?
I love the imagination and the creativity. But no, I don't think you fixed the problem at all, Robert. And that's simply because that would then require every single time that you are setting up a wall, which first of all, let's talk about how walls are created in general, because that is when you are on the team that is setting up a wall, almost always that is one of the most chaotic processes. You can decide in general, like, oh, the free kick is happening over here. Like, these people are going to be in the wall, but that's almost never how it always turns out. It's almost usually, oh, they're taking the kick quicker than we thought they're going to. Hurry up and get in here next to me, like, kind of thing. It's a very, very chaotic process almost always to get to that point where these are the people that are going to be in the wall. And then you are going to have to decide on every single free kick, different people to jump. Because if you have always like the second and fourth person or the first and third person as the ones that are jumping, then a player that is good enough to sneak a shot under the wall can just aim for that person that they know is going to be jumping. So you're talking about randomized people every time, like a randomized sequence of jumpers in a system that already has not always a consistent four or three or four people that are in the wall. And I just think that it's a little bit too complicated and a little bit too easy for it to fall apart in question. I don't think that necessarily putting a person laying down on the ground is like the most elegant solution to the problem, but I do think it is more or less an effective one and usually works unless the wall itself comes apart, as PSG found out yesterday.
All right. So Adam is anti alternate jumping. What about you, Joe?
I am also anti alternate jumping, but I love this idea so much. The creative thinking here is so good. I was just thinking, what if we could measure the most likely angles that the shooter's likely to try and hit the ball in the air versus hit the ball on the ground? Could we try to quantify that and
Joe,
then have
stop being a stats
players? It's like, but, I mean, that seems borderline possible, but then Adam, you're right. It's not really practical. Those moments are chaotic, even at the professional level. Trying to have players, you know, measure the angle. I mean, they don't have a protractor in their back pocket, right? I mean, it's not really feasible. I think at the end of the day, if you're alternating people jumping in the wall, you're just leaving yourself partially exposed in multiple areas instead of wholly exposed in one area. And maybe that's better, maybe it's not, but I don't necessarily think that this method is feasible, even though, Robert, I love the idea. So there you go.
I want to amend the question to ask, if there were a player who did have a protractor in his or her pocket, who is the player that's most likely to have one? Because my gut answer is Thomas Müller.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Somebody that's German.
Yeah. I don't think the alternate jumping would be the best idea. I am going to show my grumpy old man hand here and say that, like, every 5 to 10 years, the movie industry tries to convince us that 3D is a good thing and it's going to be awesome and it's going to make the movies better. And I don't think I've ever enjoyed a 3D experience. And I feel the same way about this player lying down behind the wall thing that everybody's doing. It feels like a thing that 5 years from now we're going to be like, oh yeah, remember that 2 months when everybody started doing that? Because it seems like it leads to, it doesn't seem like a thing they actually practice. So as soon as we get a player hit in the face and there's a concussion there, that's probably going to change it. But it also just seems like it's giving license to the wall to then sort of do whatever you want, because there's a guy laying on the ground behind you and that should work, so that you do have people jumping and turning and spinning. And I'm a big proponent of just stand where you are, put your tall people on the wall and don't move. And then you make the shooter go over top of the wall, but at least the goalkeeper can handle that a little bit more, as opposed to it going through the wall or underneath their feet or into the face of a player lying down. And now we have a concussion to deal with. So maybe that's a bah humbug approach, but I say just keep your feet and stand on the wall.
Grumpy old man status confirmed.
Yes,
right?
Yes, I will take that one. I'll take that one. Let's see how we do with the next one. Let's see if Joe is the grumpy old man this time. I doubt that for a number of reasons. Matt Koss, for official statistics like career goals, how are the qualified leagues decided upon? Is this just a FIFA vote? For example, Ronaldo has the all-time record of 602 goals, all in major competitions, but I would reckon that someone playing in, say, 8th division leagues has scored more goals in his or her 25-year career.
Taylor, this feels like a question that you can identify with, because you did that Soccer 101 episode recently on the top American goal scorers. And at the beginning of that episode, you talked about how it's kind of subjective, right? You had to draw lines in certain places. And that's my answer to Matt's question. I don't really think it's about qualified leagues or how leagues fit into how career goals are tallied. I think it's totally based on the qualifiers on the website or made by the person giving you the stat. So, for example, Matt references 602 goals for Ronaldo. I assume he's talking about Cristiano Ronaldo, mm-hmm. but maybe, Adam, he's talking about your beloved Brazilian Ronaldo. It doesn't matter, really. I looked it up, and for Cristiano Ronaldo, he has 748 career goals according to MessiVersusRonaldo.net, mm-hmm. which is a lot more than 602. That's a real site, by the way, and it's actually kind of dope. But anyway, it's 602 goals in the question, then 748 on that website, 791 according to Wikipedia, yep. even a different number still according to FBref. The key is to look at the qualifiers and what is being included in that stat, because it's going to vary from place to place. There is no, at least as far as I can tell, no official FIFA-regulated system for counting up goals.
Yeah, as far as I can tell, there is not one. And I think that is sort of where I go with this question, is that oftentimes if a number is quoted, it's being pulled from a particular site or a particular article that gave that stat. And if you go then to that article, they're probably pulling from something else. And a lot of times it comes down to sort of what the commonly held numbers are believed to be. Joe, to your point, like when I was doing that US show, the Wikipedia numbers are often different from the US soccer numbers, which are then different from the individual team numbers when you go in and look at season by season reporting for some of these players. So I think it ends up being a little bit what you're choosing to believe, what the numbers are choosing to represent, or how they're being used to represent things. But I think, isn't it Pele who has the all-time record for goals? Isn't he usually the one that's held up as scoring like 6 million goals, and they've all
probably
totally been counted?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is where I step in, because the Brazilian has been mentioned. Yeah. Pele has the Guinness Book of World Record.
Thank you.
Record for goals. And it's like 1200 or something like that. But a lot of those came in friendlies and, other types of games. So, it's not counted for many places that do this. Yeah, the answer to the question is it's kind of a crapshoot, because ultimately it's really, really difficult to determine what goals to count and what goals not to count. And as we have already displayed, even with players playing today, you have all these different numbers. You have all these different numbers for like Messi and Ronaldo. Now amplify that by history, where you have people like Pepe Bican that was playing like before and after World War II, or even Frank Puskas, who are playing when you don't necessarily have a lot of reliable stat numbers. And you see some of these places that tabulate this even have marks down that this is the number, and they have a little asterisk, and it's basically like, it's probably more than this, but we can't know for sure. And it leads me to my absolute favorite story about goal totals, and that is another Brazilian, Romario, because several years ago now, he brought to the attention of the world that he was about to score his 1,000th goal. And that was a big thing, because it only had been done by one or two other people before, Pele included. And then people started digging into how he got to 1,000 goals. And he kind of outright admitted and said like, oh, I counted every single goal I've ever scored. So it was youth academy goals were included in that. Goals scored in friendlies, goals scored in testimonial matches. I think there was a rumor that he even included goals that he scored in FIFA video games, but I don't think that was actually the case. He was counting just physical goals. But yeah, it's always kind of a crapshoot in terms of how these goal records are determined, simply because, you know, you have to determine what competitions you're actually including, what international and club friendlies count towards your goal total. You have history, you have people playing in very remote places. All of these things together combined make it kind of an impossible task to really determine who actually has the record for the most goals scored.
Yeah. And then I would even extend that, like, cause I agree with everything you said, Adam, and I would extend it to, you also have to look at like why you're tracking it in the first place. Cause there was a year, or there was a qualifying campaign, I think, for maybe the 2014 World Cup, when like Josie Altidore led all of CONCACAF qualifying in goals scored, but it was because he scored like 6 goals against St. Kitts in like the early rounds. But those still count when you look at total qualification. So I think, again, you're looking at the competition, the quality of the opponent, and then also maybe how much you trust the sites that are reporting those numbers. So overall, I'd say, yeah, there's probably somebody in the eighth division who scored more goals, but I don't really want to go in and look at every single like match report to have to do that accounting and believing in what that player is saying. So that's where I am on that one. It sounds like we're all in agreement. The final question, I don't know if we'll all agree because I don't know really even what to make of this one. It comes from Eldon Hasic. After watching Tottenham not cross the half-field line versus Manchester City, would Spurs in a Super League season have obtained more points than Schalke in the current Bundesliga season? I knew that Schalke were having a horrible season, so much so that there was violence at their training ground that I don't want to make light of that one. But looking at their table, 30 games played, 2 wins, 7 draws, 21 losses, 18 goals for, 76 against, a negative 58 goal difference. That's not great. That's not great. So the question then for you, Joe, we'll go back to Joe. Would Tottenham have done better than Schalke this current Bundesliga season?
Oh, I don't know the answer. I think yes. So yeah. I'm going to lay the groundwork here quickly. The Super League, and what it was supposed to be, I guess, was there was going to be 20 teams in there. They were going to split it into 2 halves, and they were each going to compete in home and away games in those 2 groups of 10. So if I did my math right, that's 18 goals in this little mini midweek season. So I'm saying Tottenham have 18 games to actually rack up more points than Schalke have right now. And Schalke have 13 points in the Bundesliga. And they've already been relegated and have had a very poor season, as you've already said, Taylor. For Tottenham to get more than 13 points, they would need just over 0.75 points per game. So they need a draw every game. They'd be set or a little bit less than that. They could still get away with having 14 points. I think that Tottenham would probably get to that 14-point mark, but I'm not confident about that. Looking at the teams that were confirmed to be in the Super League, Arsenal, maybe AC Milan and Juventus are like the lower tier teams along with Tottenham, but I think I have more faith in AC Milan and Juventus than Tottenham, and Arsenal and Tottenham is a crapshoot. So I'm saying yes, I think Tottenham could do it if they get the right split into their 10-team group, but man, it would be close.
All right. So Joe says, yes, they could do better than Schalke, but it would be close. What about you, Adam?
Yes, because Arsenal are also in the Super League. I mean, I think we also have taken away a little bit of from the things that Tottenham actually did this year, which included Tottenham did beat Liverpool this year. It's not like Tottenham was completely incapable of getting results at other English clubs. Tottenham did beat Manchester United, as I'm sure Taylor is aware, this season. So I think, especially with, I mean, obviously Jose Mourinho is not there, but if you foresee a future where you kind of just transplant this Tottenham under Jose Mourinho into the Super League, because we're never going to see the real Super League, or at least we're not seeing it how it was proposed, and we're not going to see it in the next year or two. Then just the way that Tottenham play, it makes getting points, like even if you're not winning the league, which Tottenham was never going to win the Super League, but they were going to get points. They're going to definitely get draws, and they're even definitely going to get some wins just because that's the style that they play. It's not going to be necessarily one that wins you leagues, as is abundantly clear in the Premier League, but it is a style under Mourinho that makes you kind of a threat at any given point to take points off of a team that people might not necessarily think that you're going to take points off. Also, Joe, you displayed a lot of faith in Dortmund this season, for not including them in the lower tier of the Super League teams that were actually proposed, because Dortmund was kind of propose as a possible member. But I don't think that you could say that Dortmund would not be one of the lower tier teams. Fair. In the Super League. And then you have the 5 qualifying teams as well, which we don't know exactly who those would include. But I think that Tottenham would definitely, I mean, you need 4 wins and a draw to equal Schalke's point total at this point. Like, even going beyond, say, we have to draw every match, you need 4 wins out of 18 games. I think that Tottenham can manage that.
Yeah, I think they probably can as well. Just because, Adam, to your point, there's for every 3-1 loss to Manchester United, there's a 6-1 win. For every like 1-1 draw with Arsenal, there's a 1-0 win. And I think you do pick up those points along the way. I think a lot of the results coming against, or stronger performances coming against, like perceived weaker opposition. I think that's where, like, for me, I then wonder, like, well, what would that require of them to change their style versus consistently stronger or as strong opponents? But maybe that's where Jose Mourinho would have had a better time, because he would have been able to sort of game plan for those big opponents and those big moments and find ways to frustrate. Sadly, that was not the case for him. We'll see how it ends up playing out for Tottenham fans and whether or not that is sad for them that he couldn't get it done. But I also
will say,
go ahead.
I will say real quickly, I misspoke. I thought that Tottenham beat Liverpool this year, and it does not appear that they did. So my mistake, they did not do that, but they definitely beat Manchester United.
That they did.
That just
they
to rub that indeed. In for Taylor.
Yeah, thanks,
buddy. Yeah, yeah.
All right, nominal fan. Anyway, since Adam has decided to bring up Dortmund and Manchester United's fragility and weakness this season, I feel like that's a good note to end on. But we think that Tottenham would be better than Schalke fundamentally. That's what we're saying?
Yes. Oh, yes.
All right, cool. Then let's end on that note. But gentlemen, thank you both for talking CONCACAF Champions League, which now feels like it was done a week ago, and answering those seven listener questions. Adam, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Taylor. Bayern and Schalke suck.
Joe, thank you as well. And I hope you you get a call about that Salzburg job sometime soon.
Oh, thank you. You know, maybe at some point it'll be the right step for me to take. No, it's always a blast, Taylor. You rock.
Listeners, thank you all very much for listening, and we'll talk to you all again soon.